Bridgebank helps breakthrough ideas actually break through and remains dedicated to providing financial solutions to the risk takers, the game changers, and the disruptors. Bridgebank, a division of Western Alliance Bank. Bridgebank, be bold, venture wisely.
Hey there, this is Brittany Luce from NPR's It's Been a Minute. KQED's podcasts like The Bay, Bay Curious, Mindshift, Right Nowish, and more all tell the stories of the Bay and beyond with reliable, human-centered journalism. They aim to inspire, make you think, entertain, and expand your understanding of the place you call home. Here's how you can support podcasting at KQED.
Showing your support is easy, and you can join Brittany in supporting KQED Podcast too at donate.kqed.org/podcast. That's donate.kqed.org/podcast.
From KQED.
From KQED in San Francisco, I'm Alexis Madrigal. Our hometown, Annalee Newitz, has a new book out, The Terraformers. It's science fiction set tens of thousands of years into the future, and there are indeed flying moose and wormholes, a variety of artificial intelligences, and wild synthetic biology. But there's a lot of Newitz's future that we recognize as part of our core urban problem set now. Real estate developers, environmental imbalances, transit surveys, and janky contracts. It's a wildly inventive, funny, smart take on what happens when the real estate industry scales up to planetary levels, and an incisive look at the hierarchies that Homo sapiens seems prone to create. That's all coming up next, after this news. Welcome to Forum. I'm Alexis Madrigal. We're joined this morning by Annalee Newitz, a true Bay Area character. She's a journalist and a science fiction writer, a thinker whose work is always surprising, as concerned with the deep past as the long future. For someone whose core themes are the elusive search for freedom from servitude, the expansion of dignity to all kinds of persons, the collapse of civilizations and environmental devastation, her new novel, The Terraformers, is anything but grim and foreboding. It's filled with jokes and resilience and lovely romance, a profusion of wild body forms and formats, sentient trains, and swimming in a caldera lake. Joining us to talk about the new book and the worldview that informs her world building, welcome Annalee Newitz.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So I want you to set up the world of Terraformers a little bit. Like, how deep in the future are we? What's happening? What of our current civilization has been cast off and kind of what remains?
So it's set just a mere 60,000 years in the future. So a lot has changed. And the novel takes place on a planet called Saski, which is being developed by an interstellar real estate company. And the novel is really in the communities of people who are doing the development for the company. So it's not... it's not about kind of movers and shakers or titans of industry. It's about workers, construction workers, people who are putting forests together and building land masses for eventual buyers. And a lot of the action focuses on a group called the Environmental Rescue Team. And they are, by the time the book happens, kind of an ancient organization. And I've been telling people that they're a little bit like Lassie's Rescue Rangers in space because they are there to be first responders when there's an environmental crisis or when there's a humanitarian crisis, as we discover later in the book. And they're a group of people who include not just Homo sapiens, but also dogs, cats, worms, naked mole rats, moose, and many other non-human animals who are now able to communicate with Homo sapiens using brain implants that let them text. So you can have a cat who looks like a cat, sounds like a cat, but while it's yowling, can send you a message saying, "Get out of my way."
Yeah, I'll eat you if you die. Yeah, yeah, right.
Exactly. Yeah. Although not in this world, because they're not going to eat each other. They're
that's
much
true.
Nicer
that's a good
than
point.
That.
How do we get to this point where all of these different non-human animals are, you know, really considered people. Like, they're people with all the rights and kind of responsibilities of people. What's the sort of mechanism by which that happened?
So we hear a little bit in the book over different scenes that there's this deep history where Earth has gone through an incredible environmental crisis. And again, this is part of such distant history that it's almost like mythology or just storytelling at the time that the novel takes place. But we know that the planet has been inundated with floods, that the resources have been depleted, people are starving. And so at that moment, which is in our future, there arises a group of activists who are interested in what they call farm revolution. And the farm revolutions are basically a much more sophisticated version of the green revolutions that we've already seen in our lifetimes, where people use synthetic biology and other kinds of sophisticated genetic engineering to create crops that can withstand climate transformation, but also, really importantly, the nascent environmental rescue team decides that the only way that they can continue to engage in land management is if they invite other non-human animals to the table to bargain with them about how the land should be used. They feel that in the past, Homo sapiens has been incredibly narcissistic and has used the land only the way Homo sapiens wants. And so they begin to experiment with building domestic animals like cows that can text and can say, actually, I'd really like for you to do this with the land. And that's sort of how the environmental rescue team is born. And by the time we see them 60,000 years in the future, they're a fully fledged organization across many planets. And many, many non-human animals have joined them in the great bargain to manage the environment.
That's right. That concept of the great bargain is a very sticky and fun thing to be thinking about. And I also love we get little bits in the book, right, of the environmental rescue team's handbook, like basically these biblical passages or you know, holy text kind of passages that are kind of passed down that people kind of use in their everyday thing, you know, like everything in balance, right?
Mm-hmm. It's more, it's funny because the Environmental Rescue Team handbook is more supposed to be an engineering handbook. It's like a, it's like the Unix handbook for the environment or something. So it doesn't, I don't think the characters see it as biblical, but they do see it as important historical knowledge. And so there is a kind of collapse between science and engineering and the world of the mystical, you might say. So they don't necessarily make a huge distinction between the two things, but they very much believe that environmental balance is a moral duty as well as a scientific and engineering goal.
Yeah. So there's been a lot of talk recently in some parts of the speculative fiction world about cli-fi, this realm of science fiction that's largely concerned with futures around, you know, environmental change. So even though this book is set tens of thousands of years in the future, would you put it on that cli-fi shelf if you were running the bookstore?
I mean, I think any book that's about the future has to deal with climate change. So I would put it in the shelf of books dealing with the future in a kind of reasonable or plausible way. And I think, you know, it's really great that in science fiction, a lot of writers like Kim Stanley Robinson, who I know has been a guest on the show, have really foregrounded that and made a point of saying, listen, like, we really need to be thinking this through in our fiction if we're going to tackle it in reality, because stories often lead the way toward things like policy and toward changing the way we live. And so I hope that the Terraformers can be part of that, of people rethinking their relationship to non-human animals and to the environment.
One of the things that really struck me is, you know, as an old sci-fi head, like when I was a kid, I would go to like the paperback bookstore, you know, and just churn through bad 1980s sci-fi. You know, terraforming is, you know, one of these hallmarks of the genre, this ability to kind of transform the way that planets work. One thing that's super interesting in this book is, like, you're kind of getting down into the contractual obligations of terraforming. And, you know, cities are also seeded in this world. Like, that's they're more akin to, like, terraforming a forest than they are something else. Was that an intentional component of this, to kind of put humans into this terraforming equation in all these different ways?
Yeah, absolutely. And I have been always really interested in a branch of architecture and urban design that tries to incorporate nature. There's a lot of architects that are working on this now. The idea of building with living materials and having self-healing structures for our buildings. But also, more importantly, this is a planet that's being developed by a real estate agency to sell to Homo sapiens, right? So they have to have places to live. It's kind of like they're building an eco-resort crossed with Disney World. And so part of the contractual obligation of this development company is that they have to build cities and they have to build a transit system to connect the cities in order to meet their obligations to their future buyers. And so one of the things I really loved in this book was thinking about how cities themselves are ecosystems and how farms are part of that. And so one of the things that we see over and over in this book is that anytime characters encounter a city, they also encounter enormous farmlands and agricultural areas to feed those cities. Because farms and cities are pretty much contiguous. Like, they absolutely develop around the same time and they feed on each other. You can't have one without the other, really.
Yeah. We're talking with writer Annalee Newitz about their new sci-fi novel, The Terraformers. We'd love to hear from you. What do you think is happening in the year 60,000? What issues are we struggling with do you think we'll still be trying to figure out in many thousands of years? You can give us a call. The number is 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, or KQED Forum. And the email is forum@kqed.org. So I know also you did a lot of research. I mean, you're a nonfiction writer and a journalist as well and have been for a long time. What was the most fun interview you did trying to, like, research what this world 60,000 years in the future might look like?
There were a ton of really great ones. I talked to geologists. I talked to atmospheric scientists. But I have to say, probably the most fun I had was talking to San Francisco head of transit, Jeffrey Tumlin, who I wanted to talk to about trains, because a big part of this book is about building public transit. And one of the characters in the book is a sentient flying train. And, you know, because there's lots of robots, so why not have a sentient train? And so I was asking Jeff about, like, you know, all the wonky stuff about how does a city develop transit? How do you have intercity transit? And I was really trying to be quite serious about, like, how can I have a realistic representation of the legal issues surrounding it? And so we talked about that for a while. And finally, I was like, listen, I have a character who's a train, and I'm just wondering, do you have any thoughts on what a train consciousness might be like? And apparently he had been, like, waiting his whole life for someone to ask him that question. He had a huge amount of information about what he thought trains would be like if they were sentient, which made me feel really happy that someone who's running transit is thinking about trains as people. And his main observation was that trains would be obsessed with strategy games if they were conscious. And because, of course, trains are constantly optimizing and thinking about, like, the best way to go somewhere and how to be, you know, serving the public in the most efficient way. And so my train character, whose name is Scrub Jay, is, in fact, obsessed with strategy games. And the entire section of the book devoted to Scrub Jay is about Scrub Jay getting away from playing corporate video games and getting interested in indie games.
True San Francisco passions here. We're talking with writer Annalee Newitz about their new sci-fi novel, The Terraformers, also the author of the nonfiction books Four Lost Cities and Scatter, Adapt, and Remember, and the co-host of the podcast Our Opinions Are Correct. I'm Alexis Madrigal. Stay tuned for more with Annalee right after the break.
Support for Forum comes from San Francisco Opera. Set 10 years after a school shooting, the critically acclaimed opera Innocence takes us into a complex emotional journey where our understanding of innocence and guilt is constantly upended. Kaija Saariaho's ethereal score collapses the past into the present as a community of survivors grapple with how to move forward. Don't miss the highly anticipated American premiere of Innocence, June 1st through 21st. Learn more at sfopera.com.
We've all got those parts of our house where the internet just won't go. Well, if you had wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity, you could worry less about dead spots. Because with wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity, you get fast speeds, reliable connection in every room, and power for all of your devices, even when everyone's online. That's wall-to-wall Wi-Fi, only with Xfinity. Restrictions apply. Not available in all areas. Actual speeds vary.
Welcome back to Forum. I'm Alexis Madrigal. We're talking with writer Annalee Newitz about their new sci-fi novel, The Terraformers. Mentioned the nonfiction books before. Also the author of the novels Autonomous and, wait, Annalee, what's the other one's title?
Future of Another Timeline.
There it is, Future of Another Timeline. I knew that. we were talking about the sentient trains in the first segment of the show. There's a piece of the book where the trains sing together. There's like a gathering of the trains. And without, you know, giving away too much or spoiling too much, we wanted to listen in to that scene, which, do you want to set anything up about like how this came together, Annalee?
Yeah, so this is from the audiobook. And this is a scene where the planet is kind of in crisis. There are a bunch of people on the planet who are protesting, trying to take the planet into being a public planet as opposed to a privately owned planet. And the trains are deciding whether to join this group. And so they're having a vote. And Scrubjay, the train, and Scrubjay's friend, who is an investigative journalist cat named Moose, have come to the vote. And this is what happens.
Scrubjay's remote bumped into the cat gently, enjoying their warmth.
No, you foolish mammal. We're going to sing. Listen, it's already started.
The cat cocked their ears and heard nothing but the buzz of insects and calls of distant birds. Slowly, the buzzing and calling grew louder, and a rolling beat thumped beneath it. The air filled with a cacophony of bees, which disintegrated into the sound of footsteps on sidewalks. Millions of feet pounding, pounding. Then came the sound of a windstorm from every direction, and inside it, the voices of moose and dogs roaring.
That was a snippet of the audiobook of The Terraformers, put out by Macmillan Audio, the book, of course, by Annalee Newitz, our guest this morning. You know, one of the things that's fascinating about that section is you had to imagine how would, like, the culture of the trains, the culture of these sentient trains. And throughout this book, it's laced through everything that there are all these other types of people aside from Homo sapiens and what their cultures and practices would look like. Tell us a little bit more about how you tried to think that through, like what the worm people would be like, and you know, what the cat people.
Yeah. So part of it was a way of thinking about just cultural difference in general. And I didn't want any of these non-human animals to be kind of cliched Disney versions of themselves. Like, I didn't want it to be like, oh, well, people who are cats love to fight and, you know, trains love to crash into things. I didn't want it to feel cliched. I wanted it to be complicated. And so when we meet non-human animals who are people, they're often at odds with each other. Like, we see them arguing, they have different perspectives. But at the same time, I did want to be true to their morphologies. And so one of the things that the trains can do is they can record sound, and they view the world as this kind of cascade of visuals and sound. And because they're moving so rapidly over the landscape, it gets blurred together. And that's why when they come together to vote, part of what they're doing is talking about what they've seen. Mm-hmm. And the way that they're communicating that is by saying, well, I've heard the wind, I've heard bees, I've heard people in cities, I've seen these kinds of people. And so I was kind of imagining that when they were voting, partly they're having a back channel conversation. They're texting each other like crazy, but that they're also singing about the kind of background of what has brought them to their opinions. But with other non-human animal characters, like there is a character who's a moose, not to be confused with the cat named Moose. There's a moose named Whistle. And I did do a lot of research on moose emotion, like how moose express emotion. And there's this great journal called Alces, which is just devoted to the management of moose and people who observe moose and who oftentimes like park rangers and stuff. And so I did learn that when moose are happy, they kick up their heels and that they also play when they swim. And so I have the character Whistle, the moose, when he's happy, he kind of goes into the water and kicks up his heels and splashes. And so we see him having these kind of characteristic moose emotional expressions, but at the same time, he has very relatable problems. He's fallen in love with another moose who kind of looks down on him, and they have this difficult romance. And so, you know, some problems cross species lines. Like, yeah, there's always going to be romantic issues, whether you're a moose or a cat or a train.
Do you think, I mean, this seems like the explosion of personhood and the conversations that people have about it in this book, because it's not as if everything is going smoothly. There are hierarchies,
no,
and there are problems, and there's, yeah, what we would kind of, I don't know, sapiensism or something.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that conversation is going to be driven more by the emergence of different emerging artificial intelligences, or do you think it's actually going to be more a greater recognition of kind of the wonder of biological brains that are not human?
That's such a good question. I think that it's happening kind of at the same time. One of the things that has been so interesting over the past couple of years is we've seen a lot of popular science books coming out about animal consciousness and perception. Ed Yong, who's a very fine science writer, who your former
friend
colleague,
of the show. Yeah.
Yeah, friend of the show. His new book is all about animal perception. Bethany Brookshire has a new book out, which is called Pests, which is all about why we demonize certain kinds of animals and how we kind of create legends and myths around, like, you know, skunks and rats and things like that, and say that they're degraded creatures. And so I think we've, partly because we're thinking about what it means to be conscious, because we're commodifying intelligence with all of our silly AI devices that we're working on right now here in the Silicon Bay area. I think that people are starting to ask questions about, well, what do we mean when we say that something is conscious? What do we mean when we say intelligence? You know, if we can have a conversation with ChatGPT, why not have a conversation with a cat or a moose or a worm? And why not use technology to help out with that? And so I think as we move forward and we start to hopefully understand better how much we depend on our environment, on all of the animals and plants in our environment, we're going to start to realize that we're not the most important brains around. You know what I mean? That Homo sapiens is not the only thinking creature. Homo sapiens is not the only creature who's important to the environment. And so that's kind of what I imagine the deep history is of this book, is that people have spent a really long time screwing up the environment, screwing up their relationships with each other and with other non-human animals, and have said, you know what, some of us are going to try a different way. Why don't we try thinking about ourselves as part of a system, part of a balanced ecosystem, where Homo sapiens is just one of many important life forms, you know, maybe not even the most important one. In some ecosystems, maybe bees are the most important. Or maybe banyan trees are the most important. Who knows? But the point is that we have to reach a point where we sort of decenter ourselves. And some of that means like letting go of the idea that we have a super special form of cognition and realize that, oh, actually, you know, we're just one kind of cognition among many, and ours might not even be the best one.
Yeah. You know, it reminds me of some of this like very early work that's been done where people are trying to kind of like to use basic Google Translate for dolphin sounds. You probably run into this
yeah.
one point or another, and you know, try and get into the water, and you know, people see that they're that you know, dolphins oftentimes will use very similar sequences of clicks and whistles around certain things, and trying to actually build that translation module, which has so far you know escaped human beings in part because the frequencies are not great for our ears, and it kind of is like you can. I could see that as like one starting point for this kind of communication, right? In if you spin it forward, you know, 500 years.
Absolutely. And that is one of the things I was thinking about, because there are a lot of scientists now who are gathering sounds from dolphins, whales, from ravens and crows, and all kinds of other non-human animals who clearly seem to have culture and are passing that culture on to their young. And I mean, one of the things with dolphins that I think is great, and whales, is that scientists have discovered that they have unique sets of sounds for each other. And you'll read papers, scientific papers, where they're like, well, it's kind of like a name. And it's like, it is a name.
It is a name.
Yeah, right. It's kind of like a name.
Yeah.
Just like we have unique sounds for each other. So yeah, I think that technology is going to help us maybe decipher what other non-human animals are saying and doing.
Let's take a few phone calls. Dan in Albany, you're on with Annalie Newitz.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yeah, sure can. Go ahead.
Yeah, I love the conversation you guys are having, talking about like the explosion of personhood and translating the languages of animals and such. So my question is, I often think about how science fiction from decades ago is notorious for not predicting the directions that some aspects of human life and culture would go. So when you look back at science fiction from like the 50s, 60s, and 70s, and I could be wrong, but like how many sci-fi books or movies were there that predicted gay marriage in the 2010s and 2020s? I mean, to my knowledge, it's like close to zero. And so I think to myself, are there aspects of human relationships and life and culture and society that might be too taboo right now in 2023 for us to predict those taboos would be changed by, say, the 2060s or the 3000s or what, you know, whatever it is?
Mm-hmm.
So my question for your guest is, what are your thoughts on the kind of failures or hesitancy of sci-fi writers and thinkers to predict things that might change that right now are taboo? Right. And I'll take my question off the air. Thank you.
Hey, Dan in Albany. Thank you. That's a great question.
Yeah, that's such a great question. So I wanted to start by addressing what he was saying about whether science fiction kind of predicted gay marriage or dealt with homosexuality before, like, basically the 21st century. And indeed, it did. I actually learned to be queer from science fiction in the early 80s when I was first reading SF. And I'm going to recommend a book for nerds who want to, like, immerse themselves in early queer SF. So David Gerald, who is probably most famous for writing the Trouble with Tribbles episode of Star Trek, where all of the little fluffy creatures start reproducing on the Enterprise and everybody is surrounded by little squeaking fluffy creatures. So David Gerald is queer and has written a lot about that. And one of his first novels, which came out in the very early 70s, is called The Man Who Folded Himself. And it's about a guy who gets a time travel device that allows him to meet himself. And he meets himself over and over again. And all of his different selves start renting a condo together. And they all start having like giant gay orgies. And it's like the early 70s. And it's just this giant gay orgy time travel book in a condo timeshare kind of thing. It's
yeah, that
really
kind of thing.
Delightful. You know, that kind of thing. So I'm just saying, like, science fiction, even before that, you know, Samuel Delaney was writing science fiction in the 50s and 60s and had lots of hints about gayness in there. So I think that things that are taboo in the mainstream culture often do bubble up in science fiction, because science fiction and fantasy are both a kind of safe space for our imaginations where we can say, oh, well, that's just imaginary. So, you know,
but I mean, now that science fiction is so mainstream relative to where it was in the past, do you think that's changing? Or do you think there's always a kind of sub rosa science fiction that is exploring those things?
Yeah, I think that even with science fiction being very mainstream, you know, with things like Wakanda Forever being like one of the top movies ever, or Star Wars being, you know, something that, you know, occupies most of Disneyland at this point, I think that it's still a place where people can let their imaginations roam free, and they can explore topics that feel too difficult to face in reality. For example, the Star Wars show Andor, which was all about a violent rebellion against colonial oppression and against basically authoritarianism, like what we're dealing with on Earth right now. A lot of people wouldn't want to watch a documentary about that, but people were sucked into the story and did empathize with the characters of the insurrectionaries who are doing things that are kind of morally gray. And I think, and I'm not saying that that's great to do things like blow up, blow up spaceships or blow up, various facilities where civilians are working. But I do think that science fiction still lets us imagine things that we wouldn't let ourselves imagine in real life. So to get to the final bit piece of that question, like what could we be thinking about now that might be taboo? It depends on your taboo, because I think one of the things that's happening in the real world right now is we're starting to see a lot more labor organizing, and there's a lot of taboos against that, especially here in the Bay Area, where like a lot of tech companies have been very anti-union and have worked hard to crush their unions. But in science fiction, we see all these representations of people coming together to fight against corporate overlords. And a lot of techies are reading that science fiction, and I think it's spilling over into real life. And so things that were once taboo, like imagining a union at your tech workplace, they're starting to feel more realistic, especially after, you know, companies decide to arbitrarily lay off lots of people for reasons that seem completely opaque.
You know, one key plot point in the book kind of revolves around the creation of and this kind of uneven adherence to a treaty between the corporate settlement entity and this band of sort of previous peoples. I don't want to do too much of a spoiler here.
Yeah.
But how much did you want this book to be read as kind of colonial allegory?
Oh, totally. It's totally an allegory about imperialism and colonialism. And a lot of it does touch on specifically California and how California has experienced colonialism. And, you know, a big part of the book is also about gentrification. So it's very much coming out of my own experiences here. A section in the book where a treaty is struck over water rights, which will be familiar to anyone who knows the history of this country and how the U.S. government dealt with various indigenous tribes. And the wording in the treaty is actually taken from a real treaty that was struck between the U.S. government and a confederacy of tribes in the 18th century. It's a peace and it's a peace treaty, basically saying that neither group will harm the other. Lifted wholesale from this previous treaty, because these were treaties that were constantly being signed and then, of course, were being violated over and over again.
I wondered how much that was based on those things. That's so fascinating. We're talking with the writer Annalee Newitz about their new sci-fi novel, The Terraformers. We're also taking some of your calls for Annalee. If you've got questions about the book and the conversation we've been having about personhood and kind of the ways we'll deal with the environment in the future, you can give us a call. It's 866-733-6786. If you're a general sci-fi nerd, what's something you've read or watched in science fiction that's now come true that we could talk about? The number's 866-733-6786. Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, or KQED Forum. And Jonathan tweets, so cool and fascinating to hear Annalee Newitz discuss their new book. I'm definitely going to get it. We'll be back with more Forum right after the break.
Support for Forum comes from San Francisco Opera. Set 10 years after a school shooting, the critically acclaimed opera Innocence takes us into a complex emotional journey where our understanding of innocence and guilt is constantly upended. Kaija Saariaho's ethereal score collapses the past into the present as a community of survivors grapple with how to move forward. Don't miss the highly anticipated American premiere of Innocence, June 1st through 21st. Learn more at sfopera.com.
We've all got those parts of our house where the internet just won't go. Well, if you had wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity, you could worry less about dead spots. Because with wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity, you get fast speeds, reliable connection in every room, and power for all of your devices, even when everyone's online. That's wall-to-wall Wi-Fi, only with Xfinity. Restrictions apply. Not available in all areas. Actual speeds vary.
Welcome back to Forum. We're talking with writer Annalee Newitz about their new sci-fi novel, The Terraformers. So one thing that's really unusual about this book and really struck me is how much time and attention you dedicate to the processes of decision-making. Like people, especially in this sort of autonomous zone called Spider City, you really get into sort of like, how do people make decisions in this future world where we're trying to imagine these sort of better relationships with each other and the environment. Can you talk a little bit about kind of what you drew on for trying to think through some of those processes?
Yeah, so part of it grew out of just thinking about how you would have democracy on a local level. So all of these groups who are making decisions are cities. So they're not trying to be, you know, serving millions and millions and millions of people the way we do with our national government here in the U.S. And I wanted to have something like a city council or, another kind of like council of elders type group that was leading discussions. And so in Spider City, which is the autonomous city, they have a council and they have, a rotating group of people who serve in the council. And the main thing that I wanted to include was that they have simple majority rule on votes, but they have this idea that there is that the minority, the group that kind of loses the vote, always gets one concession. So you never go away from the table having lost everything. So a lot of the most bitter debates come up when the minority is trying to figure out what concession they're going to get. And so there are these long council meetings. One of the chapters in the book is literally called "The Worst Council Meeting Ever," something like that. Because I think we've all
definitely
been in
a
those
Bay Area
meetings.
Book. Bay Area book.
And I was thinking about everything from what was going on before the Constitution was ratified in the United States, when people were having debates in the Federalist Papers and the Anti-Federalist Papers about how power should work, to having gone to, city council meetings. And I wanted to just show really that even in the future, when we have maybe a better handle on how democracy could work or how small groups could make decisions maybe better than big groups, you're still going to have acrimony. You're still going to have people who are so angry that they rage quit the meeting. That's not something that we can solve with taking a pill or genetically engineering ourselves. That's something that we have to solve through the really difficult process of having meetings and like having discussions. And sometimes those meetings are going to be really freaking annoying. And I think it's just a part of democracy that, as one of the characters says, like, yeah, politics are really annoying, but we have to do them.
Let's bring in Jay in Pleasanton. Welcome, Jay.
Well, thank you for taking my call. A quick comment and a question, actually. For a long time, I've been interested in the genre of sci-fi that I think I heard one of you refer to as cli-fi, a term I hadn't heard before, but sort of climate-driven stories. And the first one I'm aware of, I'm 68 years old, but I read this over 50 years ago, the book that became the movie Soylent Green, which, to my knowledge, was the first climate-driven story, at least it became a major Hollywood film. And a lot of that's coming through to now, actually. A lot of the issues are in that movie are happening now with dying oceans. My question is, the writer Kurt Vonnegut used to say, use the phrase, you are what you pretend to be, so be very careful about what you pretend to be. And it's always bothered me that so many sci-fi stories, especially the ones that get made into films, have dystopian bad futures. And I think we need to start envisioning better futures if we expect to have one. So I guess my question is, does your story, if I read it, give me hope? Is it a hopeful story? Thanks.
That's a good question, Jay. Thanks so much for that.
Yeah, that is a good question. And I think there is now a really strong movement among speculative fiction writers, people who are doing science fiction and fantasy, to imagine more hopeful futures. And I think it's for the exact reason that you mentioned, which is that we need to have stories that light a way forward for us, and that give us a model for communities we could start building, for ways that we could relate to the environment and relate to each other politically. And so The Terraformers was very deliberately my attempt to show a more hopeful future. But I will say that, as I was mentioning earlier, I don't believe that conflict will go away. I don't think a hopeful future is a future without conflict. I don't think it's a future where we have defeated the forces of greed or that capitalism has magically disappeared. I think it's a future where we see characters trying to do better and succeeding. And so that is, I mean, this is not really a spoiler. The book does chronicle a very long revolution. And that grows out of the fact that I believe that revolutions do actually take a very long time. To have a very positive, progressive revolution takes generations. And so the book takes place over about 1,600 years.
So if that gives you hope, I don't know. Yeah.
Right. I mean, but I think what we see in the book is many different strategies that the characters have for coming together as communities and pushing back against systemic oppression. And again, that's why it needs to be so long, because systemic oppression isn't like, oh, there's one bad actor. If we get rid of her, magically, we don't have this problem anymore. Systemic oppression is like, okay, we've had systems in place for hundreds of years that oppress particular groups. Those kinds of problems are built into many of our favorite institutions, many of our most powerful institutions. We have to unravel all of that. So unraveling all of that takes a really long time. And I think part of what makes a story like The Terraformers hopeful is that we have the time and the space to pull out and get this broader view of the arc of history. And we can see, look, things that we do in one lifetime actually do make a difference for people who come much, much later. And that it feels like maybe we're running in place right now, but in 200 years, people will be like, oh, thank goodness that they did that 200 years ago, because now we can build on it. And so that's what I wanted to show, is that there is hope as long as you think in a more long-term way, which we have to do if we're thinking about the climate.
Yeah. You know, I wanted to ask you about some of the things that I think are floating around in the kind of future-y world. You know, we touched briefly on ChatGPT and the, you know, kind of these large language models as they're known, which are able to kind of produce this these strings of text that can seem miraculous to some people, can seem far less than miraculous to other people. How have you found a way to make sense of those for yourself, just as a nonfiction writer who's covered technology, you know, for 20 years, and as a fiction writer too?
Yeah, I mean, I sometimes think of ChatGPT as being kind of like a horoscope, where it's, you know, it kind of is whatever you want to read into it. And so if you want to think that it's completely relevant and really important, it is. Otherwise, it's not. But really, a lot of the AI that people are excited about right now, the term AI is really a marketing term. Like, there is no actual human equivalent intelligence here. It is, as many researchers in the field, like Timnit Gebru, who was the whistleblower at Google, who pointed out that their AI system was really biased. She calls it a stochastic parrot, meaning that it's just chaotically reproducing stuff that people have already said. And so I just think of it as a way that Silicon Valley is further commodifying various aspects of our lives. So now we have this way of commodifying intelligence and quantifying what we think of as intelligence and packaging it and selling it. But it's really, it's not. It's just something that can imitate human speech. And so when I think about it in the context of science fiction, I have written a lot about, you know, human equivalent intelligence in robots and in machines. And I think of them looking back on this era and being enraged by what humans are doing and how humans are setting out to create life forms by first commodifying them, by first turning them into completely enslaved things that are designed entirely to serve us. And that's a terrible way to welcome a new form of life into the world. It's disgusting. And if we really think that we're developing something like a human equivalent life form, that we do deserve to be upbraided. You know, I hope that future robots, sentient robots, will say to us like, wow, that was really screwed up and dysfunctional, y'all. Right. That was the absolute worst way to start. So now we're going to start over again. Because it's the wrong way to begin.
Well, and one of the ways that gets expressed in the book is really that, you know, eating animal protein in the book is essentially nobody does it except for these, like, kind of this one horrible guy at the beginning of the book, right? Like, yeah. Nobody does it.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is a book where, you know, because of the fact that we've extended personhood to so many non-human life forms, it really is considered cannibalism if you were to eat a non-human animal. And in the same way, if you were to enslave a robot, it would be considered a crime. Unless, of course, you are a company that has built that robot, in which case you're legally allowed to own it, which is part of the complexity of my story, which is that, no, not all problems have been solved. Like, people are still trying to enslave artificial intelligences. They're trying to enslave each other. And part of what my characters are fighting back against is that that impulse.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of enslaved persons in this book, mm-hmm. many who are all by corporations. We're talking with writer Annalee Newitz about their new sci-fi novel, The Terraformers. They're also the author of the nonfiction books Four Lost Cities and Scatter, Adapt, and Remember, and also another great novel called Autonomous. They're also the co-host of the podcast, Our Opinions Are Correct. We've got a couple of comments I want to get to here. One listener writes in to say, Robert Hyland's Stranger in a Strange Land, 1961, depicted gender as an afterthought in sexual relations. Been a while, but I remember the main character not knowing the gender of the coworker he was going home with until they removed their spacesuits. Judd in SF writes, I'm going to order my copy of The Terraformers. I plan to add it to my collection of future possibilities, including The Three Body Problem, Broken Earth Trilogy, and Kim Stanley Robinson's Ministry for the Future. That's a pretty good shelf. This is a pledge period for KQED Public Radio and public radio stations around the country. For more information about how to support KQED, go to kqed.org. I'm Alexis Madrigal. Let's get to a couple more calls, Annalee. Let's go to Ilea in Oakland. Welcome.
Hi, thank you for taking my question. It's a question pretty much for just, you know, food for thought. I grew up in the church, and I was also, my dad was also a science fiction, well, he still is a science fiction buff. And my question is, how many Christian science fiction writers are there? And then my second question is, just as a whole, science fiction writers as a whole, how many kind of were influenced or got their stories from the Bible, especially when you mentioned slavery, you know, slavery's in the Bible, and also, you know, different arguments about who the people are. But that's my question.
Yeah. What an interesting question, Ilea. Thank you so much for that perspective.
Yeah. It's really interesting that you bring up the fact that slavery and debates over slavery are in the Bible, because that is very central, especially in the Old Testament, to questions about how we should treat each other and what it means to have dignity and what it means to be, you know, treated with kindness. And so I don't know, like, I don't know that there's any surveys out there of how many science fiction writers are Christian. I mean, certainly some of our most famous English language fantasy writers were Christian. C.S. Lewis, who wrote the Narnia books, Tolkien, who wrote the Lord of the Rings books, both of them were very religious and thought very deeply about Christianity and really are puzzling out a lot of questions, moral questions raised by Christianity in their work. So I do think that in the West, it is a huge debate, you know, how to think about a better world and how much Christianity offers us a vision of a better world. Can we build such a world on Earth? Should we not do that? My background is, I'm not a religious person. I was raised Jewish, but I'm certainly, you know, steeped in the stories from the Bible, just like any American. So I think that these things seep into the way we think about our work.
Great comment from Liz in Oakland. This is a follow-up to the caller who asked about currently taboo topics. The Kim Stanley Robinson novel, The Ministry for the Future, broaches the taboo topic of murder to prevent further climate change. Also, gender fluidity is still somewhat taboo. There certainly have been sci-fi books where characters can freely change gender when they want. Still, the ones I read were rather male-female, and I predict in the future there will be many more non-binary people. You want to take one or both of those kind of questions embedded in there?
Sure. So in the Terraformers, almost all of the characters are non-binary. this is 60,000 years in the future. So people have all different approaches to gender. There's one point where characters from off the planet meet some characters who live on the planet, Saski. And the people from off-world always introduce themselves with their pronouns. And the people who live on Saski are like, oh, how quaint. You know, we just use, we have, you know, brain implants that just sort of signal people what our pronouns are. We don't have to say it out loud. That's so funny. And, you know, but other groups don't seem to care that much about pronouns at all. And I kind of imagined that a lot of the differences that we ascribe to gender on Earth would get mapped onto a whole range of other kinds of differences in this future. I mean, we have moose characters. We have a cat falling in love with a train. I mean, it's mutual. The train loves the cat, too. Don't worry. It's, it's requited. But when you have that kind of difference, like gender difference is like just nothing. You know, it's like, okay, a train and a cat. Like, how does that work? Like, that's so much more complicated than like male versus female versus non-binary versus all the other genders that you could possibly imagine. So so this is a world where gender difference is like the least weird thing you're going to encounter. Mm-hmm. And there are hominins who are kind of like off-brand humans that have kind of a different anatomy. Anyway, you'll see if you read it. It's a very non-binary world.
Yeah. And I think, you know, one thing that's just such a delight in this book is just seeing all these different personages kind of interacting with each other in ways that feel so familiar, but also defamiliarize certain types of interactions just because of the way that their body morphologies show up or their, you know, consciousness tweaks. This is a really, really fun book. Very strong recommendation for everyone out there. You know Annalee very well from the show and, you know, San Francisco. And this book is just fully realized. Thank you so much for writing it, Annalee.
Well, thank you so much for having me. And thanks for your kind words.
Absolutely. We have been talking with the writer Annalee Newitz about their new sci-fi novel, The Terraformers, out now. Also have to put in a small plug for the audiobook, which has sound effects and is kind of like a fully realized radio drama. It's great. Newitz is also the author of the nonfiction books Four Lost Cities and Scatter, Adapt, and Remember, longtime journalist, and is the co-host of the podcast Our Opinions Are Correct. This is Forum. I'm Alexis Madrigal. Thanks for your calls and comments. Stay tuned for another hour ahead with guest host Rachel Miro.
Funds for the production of KQED's Forum are provided by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the Generosity Foundation, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Heising-Simons Foundation.
Support for Forum comes from San Francisco Opera. Set 10 years after a school shooting, the critically acclaimed opera Innocence takes us into a complex emotional journey where our understanding of innocence and guilt is constantly upended. Kaija Saariaho's ethereal score collapses the past into the present as a community of survivors grapple with how to move forward. Don't miss the highly anticipated American premiere of Innocence, June 1st through 21st. Learn more at sfopera.com.
We've all got those parts of our house where the internet just won't go. Well, if you had wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity, you could worry less about dead spots. Because with wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity, you get fast speeds, reliable connection in every room, and power for all of your devices, even when everyone's online. That's wall-to-wall Wi-Fi, only with Xfinity. Restrictions apply. Not available in all areas. Actual speeds vary.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.